The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
Welcome to Ron Paul, the weekly podcast. I'm Charles Goyette. I think you'll find this conversation a little different. It's more biographical than anything we've done. How did Ron Paul become America's leading voice for freedom? How did it begin? What were some of the events and influences along the way? Ron Paul's journey right after this.
This is Ron Paul. Thanks to our sponsors for making these podcasts available to you.
Having been through the car buying experience yourself, you'll be so glad to know about a new way to buy a car. TrueCar.com is changing everything. TrueCar.com is the simple, fair, and fun way to buy a car. At TrueCar.com, you know when you'll get a fair price because they show you what others paid for the car you're looking for. And TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. The TrueCar process, three simple steps to guaranteed savings. First, you go to TrueCar.com and find out what others paid for the same vehicle in your market and around the country. Second, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings certificate. And then the third step is so simple. Just print out your certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. TrueCar.com has the most comprehensive new car pricing information available and a certified network of dealers that offer a hassle-free car buying experience and negotiation-free guaranteed savings. It's so simple. It's really hassle-free. Just go to TrueCar.com. TrueCar. TrueCar.com.
Ron Paul. Ron Paul. This is Ron Paul, the weekly podcast.
Dr. Paul, I want to come back to college and medical school and that era in your life a little bit later, but let's start earlier. Did you have any interest in politics or economics as a boy? Were you ever subjected to a economics class in high school or in college, maybe with a Paul Samuelson textbook?
No, not in a academic sense. I wasn't introduced to economics as a young person, but I was introduced due to the type of family I came from because they endorsed the work ethic. We had a small business, a dairy. I delivered newspapers and did various other jobs. I became fascinated with coinage. I like saving coins. Back then, believe it or not, even copper pennies existed in circulation. So they actually had an intrinsic value to a penny. I became much more disappointed about collecting coins after 1975, when they removed all the silver from the currency. They got rid of the copper. And of course, the gold was taken out of the currency a long time before that. So in a very practical way, I had to learn about working and saving and planning and saving money to go to college in that way. In college, not too much interest in politics. And I had an economics course. It was terrible. Very boring, and thought economics had to be horrible. But that was a long time before I was introduced to Austrian economics. And that, of course, is a whole lot different. But I never set out as a teenager or a college student and say, oh, boy, I want to get into politics someday. But I was always fascinated with economic theories and what made the economy work and what money was all about. So that was my greater interest, was to just learn about those things. But medicine, I didn't decide on medicine until I was about a junior in college. I had started off not knowing. Then I thought I might be a veterinarian. And then I switched and had to take some extra courses. But that was not related so much to politics. As a matter of fact, later on, though, I was convinced that as I was moving through, that I would never be able to be incorporated into the U.S. Army and put into the infantry and start shooting people. And that gave me a lot more enthusiasm and encouragement to become a doctor because I was just not cut out for the other. So that is a political influence on me, and that is war and fighting and killing affected me in some way in deciding what to do in my professional career. But during those years, I became fascinated with the study of Austrian economics, which is so much different than Keynesian economics. I mean, we have socialist, radical fascism and communism, which has been proven as total failure in the 20th century. But then you had this mixture of things called interventionism and Keynesianism, where you don't have the government owning everything, but you just have them regulate things. And this is what has been accepted. But when I came across individuals like Hayek and Mises and Rothbard and Senholtz, they were explaining a different system. That really fascinated me. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became with this. So I never started to think about politics until the early 1970s, when so much of what they had predicted came true. The Bretton Woods pseudo gold standard would break down. We would sever our currency forever, from gold. And we would have chaos in the markets, big booms and big busts. And that is what we've been having. That is when I decided, you know what, I'd like to speak out on this issue. I use politics as a vehicle, not because I wanted to be in Congress or I just wanted to use this to be able to get some things off my chest. So I really didn't expect a political career. That was not my goal. And it gave me a certain privilege that the others didn't have. All I had to do is tell them what I think without, trying to outguess them on how they're going to vote for me. But I had told my wife, Carol, what I was going to do. And she had explained to me, well, that's, I don't know why you didn't do that. So that's a dangerous thing to do. And I said, how could it be dangerous? She said, well, you could end up getting elected. But I promised her that couldn't be the case because I was just going to tell people the truth and take away, and not play the role of Santa Claus that I just take from one and give to another. And my views would be so different and so strange that it wouldn't be possible. But her explanation was, people always want to hear the truth, and they're probably going to elect you just on that basis because they are sick and tired of, and that was back in the 70s. She was saying they're sick and tired of hearing, demagoguing of all the politicians. So it turned out that she was more correct, and I ended up, fortunately, to be able to practice medicine for a lot of years, delivered a lot of babies, which I loved. Was in Congress for a few years, then decided I still want to do medicine and went back for 12 years. But it just seemed like, was in the cards for me to be involved in a political way. And it's always been for one goal, to promote the cause of liberty, because, the Constitution and our traditions were pretty much aligned with that. So I didn't have to create a new system. I just had to refer back to a time when liberty was respected and that we didn't need government to run our lives, run the economy, or assume that we should be policing the world.
Well, let me back up and ask you. I remember very clearly when I first encountered Mises and Rothbard myself. It was the same time, the same place for both of them. But what about you? Do you remember when you first heard about Austrian economics, where you found it, how you started to begin reading about it?
I think it was probably during the Goldwater campaign in the 60s, and there was a reference to Hayek, and it was his first book that he wrote. And so I went and read Hayek, that introduced me, and then he had mentioned Mises, so I'd go find Mises. But it was so difficult then. It's so easy now, and that's why I think these ideas are spreading so quickly. Back then, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have many libertarian free market think tanks, but I came across Leonard Reed at the Foundation for Economic Education. And that's where I came across Mises. I actually heard Mises' lecture. I got to meet Rothbard and Senholtz, and especially Leonard Reed, who was, I considered, the most fascinating person for the spreading of the message. His approach to me was the correct one, and a lot of the things that I try to practice, I think I learned from him.
Well, he was certainly an influence on a lot of us, including myself. There is a story out there. There is, I won't say it's a legend, but certainly a story about you having an opportunity to see Mises speak late in his life, perhaps on one of his last speaking tours in Texas. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, this was interesting. There was only one other doctor in town that would even have recognized Mises' name, and that would have been, my guess is probably 1971. There was a little clip in the Houston newspapers, and we live, 50 miles out of Houston. But I looked at it and said, Mises will be lecturing at the University of Houston. So I thought, boy, I'd like to go hear him. And he was on this last tour. He was probably in his early 90s. And the only stop, the only place he could get a speaking engagement was at the University of Houston. There were no interviews. He was almost like a non-person. But actually, the University of Houston wanted him to be a non-person. But when we heard about it, I called the doctor friend, and I said, hey, let's try to go up there and hear him. And so he and I both you know, got some coverage. I left, Lake Jackson, drove up. And we got there a little bit late. So we were standing at a door. The room was a pretty small room. I would say the maximum, maybe 150 people. But all the chairs were taken. There was a lot of enthusiasm. And Mises' lecture was on socialism. But quite frankly, I have to admit it was difficult, you know, to follow because he was elderly. He was still brilliant. But he was German and he had a lisp and an accent. So you had to work real hard to listen, but it was still historic, for me. And I've always remembered that and thought that was a fascinating experience, but to actually have heard Mises, because now I think as time goes on, people will be looking back at Mises like maybe they look at Adam Smith and other great, great economists. But the most fascinating thing, that would have been 1971, but just a month or so ago, we had a little function at the Mises Institute in Houston, and a gentleman came up to me and he said that he wanted to talk about. He said, "I read in your book you mentioned that you heard Mises talk at the University of Houston," and he went on to tell me that he was the student who brought Mises to Houston at that time. And he says he remembers seeing me standing at the door because I got there a little bit late. And he remembers that. He says, "Of course, I didn't know who you were. But after I read that story," he says, "I remember that. I remember him coming and standing at the door." The other doctor and I were probably dressed differently than all the students who came to hear him. But then he went on to tell me that he had a real struggle to get an agreement to bring him there. The administration wouldn't sponsor him. The students who had to do it were arguing with him. And he joined the group that helped pick speakers. And he told me that if you had to have a unanimous vote, but if you wanted to filibuster for your speaker, you could. They couldn't close you out. So he told him, he says, "I'm going to be here for 3-4 hours, how long it ever takes for you people to agree that Mises is coming to the campus." And so he did it and brought him there. And I thought that was a fascinating story. That has to have been, 40 some years ago to meet that individual that put that little function together. But the sad part was, the university didn't care. You know, it was the age of Keynesianism, which in many ways we're still involved, in, but it's ending. Keynesianism is ending just as communism ended, and then fascism ended in the 20th century. We are now seeing the unfold of Keynesianism. So I love the idea of this linkage to Mises and listening to this great economist's lecture.
Well, 40 years from now, people will be talking about their student days and reminding one another about the events that brought Ron Paul to their attention back in 2008 and 2012. We'll continue with Ron Paul, the weekly podcast, in a moment.
I'm Ron Paul. I'd like to thank our sponsors. Their support makes these conversations possible.
With Washington spending more, always more, you won't be surprised to hear that the IRS is under a strict mandate this year to collect. If you owe back taxes, listen carefully, because their army of agents is ruthless. They can levy your bank accounts, garnish your wages, and even take your home or business. This is serious, but I have a good solution. Call the people who can help you, Optima Tax Relief, and they'll get to work pronto to protect you from aggressive IRS collection actions. Be sure to ask about their Fresh Start initiative when you call. This is a limited-time program and one of the biggest breaks the IRS has offered in ages. You could qualify for a settlement that is much less than before these changes. Nobody knows these tax relief programs like the experts at Optima Tax Relief. Get some help so you can get on with your life. One quick call is all it takes to get started on resolving your tax debt. Optima Tax Relief is fully accredited by the BBB and offers a one-of-a-kind money-back guarantee. Don't wait until it's too late. Call Optima now for your free consultation. Call 1-800-351-8385. 1-800-351-8385. 1-800-351-8385.
Ron Paul. Ron Paul. This is Ron Paul, the weekly podcast.
It's been an eventful journey for you, Dr. Paul. Where do you assess that we are today? Are we within striking distance of victory?
Well, I'm the perpetual optimist, and I believe that you know, we can talk about it and be optimistic and keep moving because things are so much better than they had been. During the 50s and the 60s, when Leonard Reed started the Foundation for Economic Education, nobody was talking about it. There was no internet and no think tanks, hardly at all. And everybody was an authoritarian, and they were still, we had a lot of professors still preaching the gospel of communism. Today, it's completely different, and the failures all around us. So no, right now, I'm an optimist that, the failures are there. They're glaring. I think the failure of our foreign policy is there. The failure of this funny money, fiat paper money system is failing. And Keynesianism is failing in that, it's given us a lot of grief since the Depression. But right now, it's giving us a lot of grief because the deeper the recession gets, the more money they print. So we're nearing a climactic end, which is very, very dangerous. And things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. But this is a tremendous opportunity for all of us to think seriously about sound economic policy. I believe we live in historic times, and just how the transition will occur, I don't know. But I know that we have opportunities we've never had before, and they're much greater than the opportunities that presented that were presented to the Russian people when the Soviet system collapsed, because they did not have our traditions. Our traditions of understanding property rights and contracts and sound money and personal liberty are very, very strong. So I think the transition into even an improved system over what we did have is very likely to happen. So the reason I'm optimistic is the fact because there are so many out there thinking about it and talking about it, and the reception on college campuses has been just fantastic. So in spite of their official lectures they're still getting on Keynes, there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of young people who are understanding now what true free markets are all about.
Yes. In fact, just one more personal note along that line. After all of your years toiling in the vineyards of liberty, when did you realize, when did it suddenly occur to you, if indeed it did at one moment, that you were having an outsized impact on this burgeoning movement?
Well, it's always been so unrealistic because, you know, I never sat down and said, well, this is my goal. I'm to become this and this. And it, like I said earlier, the goal of me speaking out was not to go to Congress. So that in itself was a bit surprising. I think the awareness came in the presidential campaigns, and one of the most dramatic episodes was when 8,000 students came out at Berkeley, and that to me was pretty fascinating. It was those moments that I knew that something was stirring, but it wasn't so much as what I had done, but I realized the grassroots effort, the groundwork has been done by the Mises Institute and the various groups to excite people because it had to occur outside of the university system. So it was during that time because I had made up my mind that, you know, not much would come of a political career. I wasn't that much interested in it. I wasn't a legislator, so to speak, and that I voted a certain way, and I was very determined to do my best to sort all the subjects out to vote in a precise manner that promoted liberty. And I thought, well, you know, I'd gone to campuses back then and I'd get 30 or 40 people. And I thought, well, I'll plant a seed here and there. Maybe someday I'll look at the voting record and say, hey, you know, that voting record was a little bit different than the others. So I was surprised that all of a sudden it burst forth and people started, you know, looking at the voting record and say, that is different, and they liked it. That, to me, probably in 07 and 08 is when that was discovered, and realizing that it was a much bigger event than Ron Paul. And fortunately, it's going to continue to grow because it is much bigger than Ron Paul. It is gigantic because we do know that ideas have consequences, and right now we're dealing with an idea whose time has come.
Well, thank you for sharing some memories with us about your journey, and thank you for another great conversation and podcast, of course. Ron Paul, the weekly podcast. I'm Charles Goyette.
This concludes another PodcastOne.com program.